This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you every Saturday here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com, where you can also look up past editions of the program. We're just 1 week away now from KMJ's Lifestyle Expo at the Radisson Conference Center in downtown Fresno. That'll be next Saturday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. And if you haven't heard yet, I'm pretty excited about some of the folks who'll be joining me. Many of the veterans that you've heard on this program who have written books about their experiences will be there selling and signing their books. My book on the Bulldog baseball team, Underdogs to Wonder Dogs, will also be there with proceeds going to the Veterans Memorial Museum. So I would love to see you there next Saturday at KMJ's Lifestyle Expo, the Radisson Conference Center, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Today, if you have veterans on your mind and you would like to help out with a very worthy cause, the Veterans Stand Down will be next month. The idea is to help those veterans who have come home from serving our country overseas, who have had trouble adjusting, who have some needs. Today at Manchester Center, on the corner there of Blackstone and Shields, there is a collection station. They need sleeping bags. Veterans, homeless veterans, can really use the sleeping bags right now. So if you have a sleeping bag or want to go get a new sleeping bag and take it by Manchester Center today, they're there until 7 o'clock to help the American Red Cross and all the organizations who are participating this year in the Veterans Stand Down. Okay, every week on this program, we talk to veterans who served our country many years ago, the greatest generation, World War II veterans, each and every week. Last week, we heard a very interesting story from a prisoner of war who spent his time in captivity in Europe. This week, we're going to go on the other side of the world and hear an incredible story from a gentleman who was taken captive at the very start of the war by the Japanese, remained a prisoner until the end of the war, and then experienced quite a remarkable reunion. We're going to hear that story from start to finish with George Heimbuch, who is my guest today. George, let's start at the beginning. I understand that growing up on a farm in South Dakota, you were a little bit of a troublemaker. Is that true?
Yeah, that was true. I was an odd one of the family, and I was the skinniest one, and I was right in the middle, just about the middle. My brother, older than me, was the middle of the family, but I was younger. So he kind of teed up with the brother younger than me, him, and they were going to have ranches and stuff. And so I kind of got pushed out of that little thing, you know. So I had to stir up something on my own.
You got pushed out of that, and then you got kicked out of school.
Yeah, I got kicked out of school, too.
But somewhere along the line, you found a little discipline, I guess.
And oh, yeah.
I'm sure Uncle Sam gave it to you once you joined the Army Air Corps. When did you get involved in the military, and what drove that decision for you?
We were in Billings, Montana. After I got out of CC camp, we went to Billings, Montana, and I sold vacuum cleaners for Cease Musburger. Mm-hmm. His son is Brent. You probably heard of him. Yeah, I babysat him for a long time. In fact, they had me living with the family.
You babysat Brent Musburger?
Oh, yeah. I taught him his first words.
Touchdown?
No, bulls.
Good thing we have a bleep button for that one.
Yeah.
Well, I hopefully he doesn't say that in his current line of work, because he'll get in trouble.
No, I don't think so.
So you went from babysitting Brent Musburger to what?
Yeah, and we sold vacuum cleaners. I did pretty well. I sold them, but my brother didn't do very good, so I had to kind of help, you know. And then one day he came in and said, after about a year we'd been working there, and he said, I'm going to join the Air Force, Army Air Corps at that
right,
time.
Right.
And so I thought about it, and I thought, well, heck, I may as well go too, because the war in Europe had started, and I knew we were going to get in it. So I figured I may as well start, you know, and train to be a pilot. That's what I wanted to do.
Of course.
With no education. And that didn't work out so good either.
Well, I have yet to meet a veteran who served in the Army Air Corps in World War II who didn't choose that branch of service because he wanted to be a pilot. Now, they ended up bombardiers, navigators, serving on an airstrip, right. But they all went in because they wanted to be a pilot.
Yeah. I worked in a motor pool for a while, and I didn't like that. So I told the first sergeant I was in my line of work, you know, and he said, well, come on up in the orderly room then. So I worked in the orderly room, made out the morning report and stuff like that. And I liked that. We were having a good time there. And then we got orders that we were going to go overseas. I didn't like that at all.
And this is top secret at the time. Pearl Harbor hasn't happened yet, but the government has something, Operation Plum, and it has nothing to do with the fruit on a tree, but this is what you're talking about, right?
This is what I'm talking about, uh-huh. Plum. And we figured out it was the Philippines before, you know, very long. It was kind of really exciting, you know. I'd never been on a ship.
They don't have a lot of those in South Dakota.
Not a lot, and I'd never seen the ocean, and so this was all pretty new to me. And I got on the train and rode in the Pullman, you know, bed, everything. That was pretty new to me, too. I had a real good time. When I was in the CC camps, I spent my whole paycheck learning how to play poker.
Uh-huh.
And it cost me. But when I got out of CC camp, I knew how to play poker. And so when I got in the Air Force, or Army Air Corps, boy, that was easy picking. They always wanted to start playing poker, and I was winning poker. Boy, I was really cleaning up.
So I believe it was late October of 41 that you shipped out for the Philippines?
Yeah.
Did you have a sense that this was going to be the same kind of duties, that you weren't necessarily going to a war zone? Or what was your
state
of mind? Yeah,
we had no worry about a war. We knew that the Navy was told us that they could bottle up the Japanese fleet in 2 weeks, so we kind of wanted the war to start so we could get back home.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they hit Pearl Harbor, and we had a beer party that night because we knew the war had started and we were going to get home pretty soon.
And when that happened, December 7th, 1941, you were in the Philippines?
I was in the Philippines on Mindanao, the southernmost island.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty wild place, and we were just set out there in a big pasture, and that was our runway. And we had B-17s come in for practice, and they were there when they hit Clark. So they saved like 14 of them.
When they hit Clark Field in the Philippines,
yeah.
You had B-17s on your base.
Yeah. So those they saved, you know, and they went to Australia.
So you had a party that night.
Yeah.
But I imagine it wasn't too long before you realized the war was coming to you.
That's true. That's true. Big time.
Tell me about that. What do you remember about the
first? Well, the first combat I had was we were put on the gun pit on the field.
Mm-hmm.
We were right on the field, which was a dumb thing to start with. But anyway, my brother and I were on it, and it was afternoon, and Four planes came over there. There were fighter planes. They came over and went into the sun, and then they come down, and while they were coming down, we thought they were going to land. And they started winking. We could see the blinking, you know, and pretty soon we could hear the bullets hitting the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I jumped up and got on the gun, and I couldn't get the first one by, but the second one, boy, I was on him, you know. But aiming right at him, I had no idea you were supposed to aim way ahead of him. You know?
You'd never had any training on anti-aircraft fire.
Yeah, none at all. So I put some bullets in the air, but without any effect at all. I should have had some, you know, if I had known what I was doing. I had a good shot at him, but.
Is that something that was over in a hurry, or did it seem to rage on for a while?
No, it was over in a hurry. One pass, and they were gone. They were they knew they'd found the field, you know. They didn't even know it was there at that time.
And that kind of gives you a hint they might be coming back.
Right. We knew they were going to come back. And they came back on December 19th, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
And one morning I looked up and, holy Toledo, there was a flight of bombers coming over us. And they looked like they're right over you, you know. No matter where you are, they're right over you. So we got down the hole of our gun pit, you know, and they dropped their bombs where the barracks were. We were way on the other end of the field, so we didn't get any bombs dropped on us. But We did get one dive bomber that come at us and dropped a bomb at us, but he missed us by quite a ways.
Which made you feel a little better?
Yeah, Ray jumped up and got on the gun that time.
That's your brother?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I didn't want no part of that gun. I was staying in the hole. And that just scared the tar out of me. I just never believed this could happen. You know?
Well, I was just about to ask you. I think you kind of answered my question. A few moments ago, you described getting on a Pullman for the first time and seeing the ocean for the first time, and this is a big adventure for you.
Yeah.
Guess it didn't feel like an adventure anymore.
This was no adventure.
Well, I can tell it's still a powerful memory for you. I think we're at a good spot for our first commercial break, so we're going to take that, then come back. So far, we haven't heard about how George was captured. We're going to hear about that when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, George Heimbuch, a veteran of the Pacific Theater of World War II. He spent most of the war as a prisoner of war, but we haven't heard that part of his story yet. We heard why he got into the U.S. Army Air Corps. What else? He wanted to be a pilot. That wasn't what he ended up doing, but he ended up on the ride of his life shortly after Pearl Harbor when the Japanese attacked his installation on the Philippine island of Mindanao. You heard him describe shooting at those incoming airplanes from the ground on the field as part of the 5th Air Base Group. But so far, George, you haven't told us about when you were captured. I'm sure that that's a day that, even if you wanted to forget it, you've never been able to. Tell me about that.
It was Mother's Day.
Really?
May 10th, yeah. That was pretty... We thought about Mom. The way I got captured was I was on the front line for about a week and a half. And so when they told us we were going to surrender the next morning, they said we can take off, you know, back off the line. So I took off and I went to the motor pool. I wanted to let Ray know where I was. I was going to go up in the hills with a group, with a radio group there.
And Ray is your brother. You had gotten into the service because he was going in.
Yeah, he was back in the back area, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so I wanted to go back there and tell him. And these guys said they'd wait 2 hours for me. Well, I knew I wasn't going to make it in 2 hours, but I was going to go up anyway, you know, and catch them.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the motor pool, and the sergeant said, I've had orders to keep all the vehicles that come in the motor hole. But he said, that one is one of these kind of open-air, four-wheel drive jobs, you know.
Uh-huh.
He said, that one is loaded with gas. And he said, I'm going for coffee, and I don't want to see you when I get back. So he
basically said, take this Jeep if you want it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I took it, and I headed back. I knew where they were because I knew where Ray was because I helped the guy build the road. I built the road into it, and the lieutenant I was with built the houses with a bunch of Filipinos.
Uh-huh.
So I worked down there before, you know, during the war. I was all over the place during the war. So anyway, I started down. Then he told me, we got a roadblock about 5 miles down here. And he said, you can turn off. There's kind of a path you can watch for. So I did. I watched for it and turned off my lights and turned off and went around them, got back on the road and got on down there. And got Ray, and I told him I was going to go head out into the woods, you know. I just wanted to let him know I was going. And he said, I'm going with you, you know. And about five guys in the squadron said, we're going with you too, you know. So they had no food, no nothing, but we were going anyway. So we took off and about 20 miles before I got to that turnoff, they throwing up another roadblock. And I come over the hill. I was driving, I come over the hill, and there they were. And a guy out in the middle of the road stopped us, and about 100 jabs raised up on each side of the road, you know. So there, and there was, we couldn't, there's a ditch, you know, each side, we couldn't turn around. We were bought right there. So he told us to get out. We were all armed. And he said, leave your arms in the truck and come out with your hands up in the air and nobody will get hurt. And there's quite a few guys there already they'd caught, you know, so.
You didn't have much choice.
We didn't have much choice. That's how we got caught.
Now, let me take you back just a moment. You said you went looking for Ray. You were going to go hide out in the woods. Were you trying to avoid surrendering, or had you come to grips?
Oh, yeah. I wasn't going to surrender. I was going up in the hills. And as it turned out, that would have been a pretty good idea because they'd formed kind of an army back there, and we'd eventually found them, you know, and joined them. So,
with some Filipino guerrillas, you would
no,
have met
Americans,
up with them.
Americans.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
So you basically were saying, the general says we're surrendering, but we're going to try to do it on our own.
No, we were. I was going up in the hill.
Uh huh. So, but the Japanese got you before you could get there.
They got me before I could get there.
But you and your brother are at least together. You're facing this together at that moment.
Yes. Yeah, we were in a prison camp together. I was a barber in CC camp, so I cut hair and made money. And every twice a week, I think it was, they had civilians line up and kind of form a PX. You could buy food, you know.
Now, this is the first prison camp that you're in.
It's the first one.
In the Philippines.
In the Philippines. We could go swimming. We had a great swimming hole. And they'd march us down there, you know, and we'd swim for a couple hours.
You're describing it as a pretty carefree experience, but I imagine there's some part of you that says, how long is this going to last? How long is this war going to end?
We thought that was it, you know. We really did. We thought this was going to be really neat, you know. And we were glad that we didn't have to fight anymore because we were fighting with nothing, you know, to start with.
I kind of glossed over that. The troops in that area at that time were greatly undersupplied. You didn't have the equipment or the food supplies that you needed.
We had no airplanes, no artillery. The 50 caliber was the highest caliber we had there on the front line. And these old infield rifles.
World War I rifles.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And World War I caps, you know, them crazy little things they had.
So against that backdrop, this prison camp in the Philippines was actually an improvement for you.
Oh, yeah, that was a big improvement.
Now, you told me something. The Japanese officer running that camp had been a prisoner of the Americans?
Us. Yeah.
And because of how he was treated by the Americans when he was a prisoner, treated you guys well.
That's right.
Boy, that says something, doesn't it?
Yeah, we really had it nice.
And you and your brother were there together.
Yeah, and the first problem I had was we were putting a water line into the camp, and I was working on that. And this officer in charge, the captain, American, the last piece that went in, he said, cut 3 inches short because we're going to take the sag out of the line, see? So I cut it 3 inches short exactly and put it in there, and they pulled and tugged the line, but there was no sag in it. So I cut it too short, see? And he said, well, I'll put another piece in there. So I took it out, was cutting a bigger piece, longer piece, and this Jap colonel, I think he was, or whatever he was, I don't know, saw me, that I'd screwed up that one piece.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, he got mad. And I was standing there in front of him. And the captain was right there that told me to do it. He just sat there. He didn't interfere at all, you know. And so that officer took a swing at me, and I blocked him, which is a very bad thing to do, you know.
I can only
but
imagine.
I just couldn't let him hit me. So anyway, he pulled off his sword. He didn't pull the sword out, thank God. He just pulled the whole thing out, and he whopped me alongside the head with that. And
so with the sheath that his sword went in, he
hit
you on the side of the head.
Yeah, he
had
the sword and the sheath, and he hit me with the sheath, and Then he told me to go ahead and finish it, so I went ahead and finished it. That's the first incident I had with him, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was boiling, boy. I was really boiling. First, that captain, he should have, you know, stepped in and said, I told him, you know. But he didn't. He just let me stood there and let me get through that thing.
So I guess that was the first sign you had that this isn't the luxurious situation that you thought
right.
it was.
Right.
And how long was it before they put you on one of those notorious hell ships and sent you back to mainland Japan?
I guess we were there about until August, May 10th until August.
Mm-hmm.
And then come out with a list of 40 that they wanted to transport out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the list, and my brother wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided we'd just leave it that way. We wouldn't, because one of us would have a better chance, you know, to make it through. Because we knew now it was going to get a little rougher.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how much of a difference did that make for you during those 3 months at that camp in the Philippines to have your brother there, to have someone that you could see every day, to talk to realize you're not in this alone? How big of a difference did that make for you?
That was pretty good. A lot of guys I knew, you know, I had friends there that we developed during the summer we were in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was pretty nice. And I was making a little money, you know, buying food.
Playing poker?
No.
You couldn't play in the camp.
We didn't try playing poker there.
Well, I think we're at a point where we need to catch another quick timeout. But when we come back, we're going to hear about George's ordeal on a hell ship crossing back to mainland Japan and his time in captivity there, his liberation, maybe a little bit of what he's done since and what it all means to him today. George Heimbuch, ex-prisoner of war from the Pacific Theater in World War II, is our guest today. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A reminder that next Saturday, this show will be originating live from KMJ's Lifestyle Expo at the Radisson Conference Center from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. next Saturday, including Hometown Heroes Live from 1 to 2. Today, our guest is George Heimbuch, who was a prisoner of war in the Philippines and Japan during World War II.
And I want to hand out a big thank you to Pastor Steve Williams of North Point Church, who was the first one to tell me about George and his story. If you attend that church, you might bump into George as an usher, a greeter, handing out bulletins as you walk into the sanctuary there. And I bet you had no idea that he has endured as much as he has. It's an incredible story of survival. And I know that this short program can't do justice to all of it, but we're going to try to fit in as much as we can before this program's over. So we've heard about how he got into the service, how he became a prisoner, about his time initially in a prison camp in the Philippines, and I guess we'll move on from there at this point.
When we left off, he was about to be sent out of his camp in the Philippines with 39 other prisoners of war, and before taking you to Japan, they sent you up to Manila.
They didn't tell us we were going to Japan. They just said we're leaving, you know, so.
Yeah, they usually don't print out an itinerary for you, do they?
No, they don't. They tend to give you a pretty short idea where you're going to be. So anyway, we went up in this inner island boat, and that was a pretty nice trip. And we got to Bilibid, and boy, it got rough there. And that's where I saw all the guys that were on Bataan and had their legs shot off and their arms shot off, and they were just a body sitting there, you know. That really got to me.
And I guess that probably tells you how fortunate you were to have missed that.
Yeah, I was really lucky.
Because those were all guys that went over to the Philippines at the same time you did.
That's right. A lot of them were.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to talk to them, but they were out there, but they would just look at you, you know. And so I didn't try anymore. But they'd carry him out in the sun and then carry him back, you know. Oh, man, I just couldn't believe that. So then we got ready to go, and they had 2,300 of us, two other prisoners, you know, got up there, and marched us through the dock there in Manila Bay. And here was this rusty little boat, you know. We thought, well, 2,300 on that boat, that'll really fill it up. Well, it turned out we weren't going to have the boat. We were going to have the one hold and the front end, 2,300 of us. So we knew we couldn't get everybody on, so we would let the dumb bastards find out, you know. So we got on the boat, and we just kept going, and pretty soon we were filled up. The hold was filled up, and the front was filled up. We said, we're full, no more room, you know, and they were all way lying down on the dock yet, you know, to get on. And so they took three Japs with bayonets and come up, and they really were jabbing the guys that were, you know, of course, they piled back on top of everybody, and everybody just piled on each other. And then this interpreter says, oh, lots of room, come on. And they started them up, and that's where they load the rest of them. About three times, four times, they took that, made that bayonet run, you know, to load them up.
So you end up smashed into this room.
We were smashed on the front end. I was down the hole, but I'd come out on the way because I knew I wasn't going to make it down there. You know, I wanted air. So it took me forever to get up, and I passed out. and I passed out when I come out the door. And when you passed out, you didn't want to lay long because you're going to go overboard, you know. But they didn't want,
right.
They want a room more than anything. So Pappy Nettles, my good friend from the Philippines.
From the sound of his nickname, he was probably an older soldier.
Yeah, he's 55.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So he was a lot older than we were anyway. We called him Pappy, and he is a master sergeant. And so we kind of respected him. He was a really nice guy. And he said, hand him over to me. So they picked me up and was handing me over, and I woke up when they were handing me over, you know. And I sat down beside Pappy and kind of crouched and sat. We just piled in there. So he said, I got an emergency ration here. He said, and I think this is an emergency. So we'd been out about 2 days, I think, and we hadn't had any water yet or anything. And they gave us some hardtack, what we call hardtack, but they were in balls, and they were in soap boxes. So they, when we got them, they were just soapy, you know, and we all got diarrhea from it, from the soap, and nowhere to go. They had a latrine on the side of the ship, but you couldn't get to it, you know.
You were tight, packed in so tight, you couldn't move.
So you just went where you were, let her go, you know, and forget about it. And some guys, you know, rail, you know, to do it. And they'd holler, look out, you know, and here it would come, and we'd duck down, and you could feel it splat. 90 days.
90
No, 40 days.
40 days in the hold of that ship.
Like that.
But it sounds like you're telling me that when you passed out, if Pappy Nettles hadn't taken care of you, you would have been somewhere on the bottom of the sea.
Oh, yeah. They'd put me over. That even didn't last long. But anyway, I think I'd have woke up and grabbed for the rail if they'd tried to put me over. But he shared a can of Eagle Brand milk.
Uh-huh.
And, oh, man, that was great. I only got about 3 spoonsful. He ate it, you know, but I let him eat. But I got about 3 spoonsful, and that really, really put me in better shape than I was in, you know.
Well, I can tell, and I think our listeners can, why they called these hell ships, because it sounds like it certainly lived up to the name. So you,
About the third day, they gave us water. They put a hose out, you know,
uh-huh.
So we all got water, and that was a godsend.
It occurs to me that, and you mentioned they would have thrown you overboard. How frequent was it that someone died and they were passed out of
there? It was pretty frequent, but we lost a lot of men. But it just got where you didn't pay no attention to it, you know. That wasn't a big event in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just didn't worry about that. We landed in Korea.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And they unloaded 1,400 in Korea,
mm-hmm.
or 1,500. And I was on the way off, and they cut it off. And I'm glad they did, boy. I was glad then they did. I didn't want to go to Korea.
Mm-hmm.
It got cold in Korea, you know. So Then there was only like 500 of us on the ship. The first day we got a soup, a fish soup that to die for. Man, that was the best tasting thing I've ever eaten.
After starving on a ship for over a month, that tasted pretty good.
Yeah, man, that tasted good. And we thought, well, this is now we got it made, you know. And we had that hose out there, and we showered and got cleaned up. We went through a few storms, you know, rain storms coming, and so we got cleaned up a little when we did that. And we got the tail end of a typhoon on the way, too. So we took some green water on the front on those waves, huge waves. I couldn't believe the ocean did that. Man, that was amazing to see a wave that size. Our ship was just nothing compared to that wave, you know.
And I imagine you probably wouldn't have minded if the ship was blown to pieces. And
not really. I wasn't scared, you know.
I'm sure you've already lost some weight by this time. But that camp in Japan, I understand, didn't have quite as nice accommodations as what you'd experienced in the Philippines.
No, that was bad. That was bad. They put 200 of us in that camp. And, boy, we lost a lot of them that first winter. It was really rough. And those balls we got, you know, that were soapy, guy threw them away. Somebody did. And there's about three of them floating, and the colonel come in to inspect. And he cut our rations by a third because we were throwing them away.
Oh, man.
So, and the guy went off to war somewhere and he never come back. So we stayed on two-thirds ration, where the rest of them were on full ration. We were on two-thirds.
Oh, that's awful. Hey, you mentioned the winter. You lost a lot of guys. Was there anything you could do to deal with the cold? Because I'm sure you didn't have much clothing. Most of the images and the stories I've heard from POWs there, you had basically a loincloth, and that was about it.
For underwear, we had a loincloth. And then they gave us clothes, but you could see right through them. You know, you couldn't wash them because they just turned to snot when you washed them.
Like tissue paper.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they were really bad stuff. There was no warmth to them. The wind just came right through them.
So what did you do to stay warm?
You didn't.
Could you huddle up with other prisoners, or that didn't do a whole lot of good
huddled
either?
At night, we had two blankets, and we had 24 guys in a room about this size, and they had two bunks, platforms built on each side of the room. So they put six men on each platform, so that'd be 24 in a room. Mm-hmm. And I was on the top on one side, and we were cold, and so we said, why don't we, three of us, make a bed, you know, with our blankets, and then we take turns sleeping in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
The middle guy got warm.
Exactly.
And that's the way we did it. And there was lice in there, graybacks.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just horrible. You couldn't get them out of your clothes because you had to boil them, you know.
What kept you going through all this? Because I imagine when you're in this situation day after day after day, you wonder, how long is this going to last? Am I going to survive? How did you get through that?
I kind of wanted to get back. I knew I was going to make it some way.
Well,
I never thought I was going to die.
Maybe that's why you didn't.
Yeah, I really did. I didn't think I was going to die. And so it wasn't no problem for me.
Well, we're going to hear about some more of what he had to face and how he survived to be sitting here with us today. Clearly, somebody had other plans for him, and we're very thankful for that. We'll take our final commercial break, then finish up with the stirring conclusion from George Heimbuch today on Hometown Heroes. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Coming down the home stretch of Hometown Heroes today, as usual, the time has gone by way too fast because I know that George Heimbuch could fill another two or three shows with some of the things that he endured.
Absolutely.
As a prisoner of war. Now, every POW I've talked to, especially someone who was imprisoned for as long as you were, 3.5 years by the time the war was over,
mm-hmm.
the physical transformation was incredible. And I understand in your case, not only were you losing weight, but you were growing taller.
Yeah.
And you were only about 90, 92 pounds, somewhere around there?
Yeah, about 92 pounds when they weighed me one time, and they didn't weigh us anymore.
What had you been before the war?
How 145, much? 150, right in there.
But I understand even at 92 pounds, you were having bodybuilding competitions with your buddies?
We entertained them for a while. We had a crowd, and they were just roaring.
Seeing who had the bigger muscles on those, I guess finding some humor in the midst of misery there. How often, I'm sure, even if the Red Cross parcels got through to you, you didn't get all of them.
No, we got half. We only got half. Ray's camp got the whole package, and they got all the other. They sent extra, you know, in bulk to every camp. Ours, we didn't get. You know.
Which, of course, I'm sure, and you're talking about, again, your brother Ray, who's imprisoned at another camp. You didn't know for sure if he was alive or dead or what?
No, I had no idea whether he made it or not.
And with these Red Cross parcels, I understand that one time you thought the Red Cross was kind enough to send you a little red bar of soap that turned out not to be soap.
Yeah, that was in the, they was in the in the, I guess, the bulk that they sent to the camp, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it was a chunk of cheese about 6 inches long and you know, square like a cheese. It was a nice chunk of cheese, and it was wrapped tight with cellophane.
Uh-huh.
And this guy looked at it, and he knew it was soap, you know. So this Jap went to the bathhouse with this thing, and we watched him. We were wondering what he's going to do with that cheese, you know. And he went in there, and he was trying to soap up with that thing. And it just wasn't lathering, and he threw it out the window. He said, "That's nothing but Americano sea can dummy, you know, soap's crazy."
So then you got to eat the cheese.
Yeah, and they threw it, and he threw it out the window, and four of us went for it, see. So we had a split between four of us, and we ate it right there. And we didn't let him see us eat it, but boy, oh boy, was that a feed.
That was a treat. Did you ever get to a point where you ate more than your stomach could handle because of how emaciated you were?
No. I was a little smarter than most of those guys. A lot of them just chow down on those Red Cross bars. But I ate just a little every night, you know, give me a little more energy. Mm-hmm. And mine lasted quite a while. And in fact, I got a can of Eagle Brand milk.
Uh-huh.
I got, in devising it, I got the Eagle Brand milk, and I was saving that for an emergency.
Just like Pappy had done for you.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. I knew that would be a pretty good emergency thing, you know. So I was saving it, and about January or February it was. I went downstairs when I lived upstairs, and I went downstairs and went through there, and here was a guy laying in blankets just steaming. And I asked the guy, I said, "Has he quit eating?" And he said, "Yeah, he quit eating yesterday." So I knew he was really close. So I found out it was Maury McLeod. I knew him. I wasn't a real good friend of him, but we kind of liked each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave him my milk. I got this tea. We got a hot canteen cup full of tea every night. It was just hot water, you know.
Right.
So I got his tea and took it up and opened my milk and put half of the milk in there and stirred it up. And I took it down to him. And this was in the morning. And I told him, I said, "Maury, I want you to taste this." And he said, you know, he was kind of growing. I said,
he was ready to die.
Yeah, so I moved his head and I said, "Come on, taste that." And he tasted it. And then I've never seen a guy do that. He just kind of opened his mouth and poured it down. I've never seen a guy do that. And it just amazed me. And then that night I did it again. And the milk was gone then, but then he started eating that night and come back.
And I'm sure he's told you a time or two since then.
Yeah.
That you saved his life.
Yeah, he did. You know, he was pretty pretty, but now he don't think it was much of a deal anymore.
At the time, he thanked you.
Yeah, he's had time to kind of let it go. So anyway, what was I going to say? I had a big story to tell right here.
Well, I understand that that's something that you did a fair amount of, trying to motivate your other prisoners to hang on, to keep living, to not give up.
Yeah, we had a terrible, terrible meal there. We got the soup was just radish tops, the daikon tops.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we got salt in it, sometimes we didn't, just the radish tops. But the doctor kept telling us that we got the best part, you know. Boy, just enjoy it, you know, while you get it. So anyway, we made it on that. And we had barley and hog millet. This I don't know if you know what millet is.
Uh-huh.
That's what we had mixed with barley. And that was our ration. So it was pretty bad.
But you found a way to survive, as you've described, and as 1945 wore on, I'm sure you started to get rumblings that this war is almost over. We might be free pretty soon.
Yeah, what started really the comeback was we were out there chipping on some cooling pipe that they had, and they were cooling acid run through there. So I was chipping on this, and one day we looked up, and here was a 4-engine plane way up there, you know. And we said, they ain't got no 4-engine plane to go that high. And this plane just kept coming around Tokyo, you know. Got about halfway around when the sirens went off. We said, hey, that's our bomber.
That's a B-29 up there.
Yeah. And that sucker, they were flying an aircraft at him. They were about a mile below him and a mile behind him. He was just cruising, boy. I mean, he was stripped and had cameras, I think is all he had. But he come over our area, come all the way around Tokyo and come over our area. And that was a great, great lift, boy, I'm telling you. We knew we were on our way.
Mm-hmm. That they knew where you were? Because he was taking photos and hopefully had seen that indeed was a prison camp down there.
Yeah. But I want to get back to a little earlier. How much time have we got?
We're running short here, but I'm listening. So,
I got down where I was really low. I was going to stay in bed and let him beat me to death one morning. And his buddy beat me, said no. He said, George, you're going to get up this morning. Tomorrow morning, he said, you can stay in bed.
Uh-huh.
And I got up and went to work, but I was feeling just horrible. And I was just had, like, no energy at all. I just run dry.
Sure.
You know. And that day, the worst guy in camp come out to work, and they called my number. And this is the only time a number had appeared in camp. And it was me.
Mm-hmm.
And to go to the hospital. And we sent about five guys or six guys to the hospital, and they'd come back in white boxes, you know. We never got anybody back alive. So
you didn't want to go to the hospital.
This was a bad deal, no.
Uh-huh.
But I was going to go. And it didn't bother me a whole lot because I was going to die anyway, you know, and I figured, what the heck. So he took me to the – they had a sergeant take or army guy take me to the hospital, and they burnt my clothes to get rid of the lice, and they gave me a bed with sheets and a pillow with a pillowcase on it, and two blankets on the bed. I just fell in that bed and went to sleep, and these guys in camp said, I think he's got sleeping sickness is his problem, you know. But the guys that were in the hospital, they had a, it was like an army hospital, you know, with all the wings on it. But uh-huh. We had one wing to ourselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The prisoners did. And they said, boy, this is a good place once I woke up, you know. And they'd wake me up to feed me. And then they said, come on, we got to take a bath. And, oh, man, a bath. And they give us clean pajamas, you know, and clean sheets. And for bath day, twice a week, we got a bath, hot bath.
Which is heaven compared to what you'd been dealing with.
Oh, man. And I stayed there, and I stayed there, and I stayed there. All of them went home or died or got sent to camp. And finally, I was alone there. And I stayed there for 2 months until I finally decided I wanted to hear some English. I learned to speak Japanese, by the way.
Yeah.
Fairly good. And this captain always come into my room and say, "You hear the good news?" And I said, "What good news?" He said, "A cruiser, American cruiser bombed down." And I said, "That's good news?" He was trying to do everything.
Trying to get your goat.
Yeah, that's the worst they could do to us there. But, boy, that was a neat place. I got all my weight back to 150.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I made it. That's how I made it back.
Well, it sounds like a life-saving situation. We are just about out of time, but I can't let you go without telling me the story of being liberated and then running into somebody that you might have spent some time with before, that you might have been looking for a while. Tell me about how you and your brother ran into each other again.
Well, we took over our own camp when we found out that interpreter said that there was a truce. Well, we knew there was no truce. We knew it was over.
Right.
So we took over the camp, and we went out on forays, you know.
Yeah, I hear you even stole a train full of sake at one point, which is a story in itself.
Yeah, we got a truckload of sake in those in the 5-gallon jugs, you know, with the straw on it. They loaded the truck up. Two guys found it. I didn't find it. Two other guys found it. But they brought it into camp, and we had all canteens filled with it when we went on the train to Tokyo when we went. They said, "This train don't go to Yokohama. They said, "This train don't go to Yokohama." And Papinello said, "Yeah." He said, "You get ready to go to Yokohama because that's where we're going." And you know, he was on the key, you know, and they took us into Yokohama, all right.
I believe it. Well, we got about a minute left here, George. You're liberated, and you're thinking, "I'm going to get to go home, and I'll find out at some point if my brother's still alive or not, if he made it through the war as a POW. And tell me about how you bumped into him.
Well, we were in a tent. All of us were in tents, and I asked around, and nobody knew anything about my brother. Mm-hmm. And they had a staging area where they announced guys that were going to leave that day. So every morning at 4, I'd get up and go down there, see if they announced his name. See? And he did the same thing, see if they announced my name. And there was a ditch there full of water, and they had a plank across it. And one morning I went down there, and it was raining. It was pretty miserable. And I come back. And I stepped on that plank, and somebody was on the other end. And I said, "Excuse me." And I stepped off, and he said, "George, there's my brother."
The guy that you asked to get off the plank was your brother.
Yeah.
I imagine that was a pretty big hug right about then.
Yeah, that was a big meeting. Yeah, we had a good time there. Excuse me.
No, I think everybody understands why that means so much to you. And on that note, we're out of time on the program today. But, George, it's been a great pleasure hearing some of your stories. I know there are many more, so maybe we'll have you back again. And thank you for serving our country and for having the courage to talk about it today.
Thank you.
That's George Heimbuch, our guest today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.